Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
Today's program has been brought to you by Wines of Bordeaux. Visit their website at bordeaux.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome, Mike Colomeco here, Food Talk. We're live today out of Bushwick. It's October. It's fall in New York City. Great time to be here. It's a real pleasure today. I've got a really interesting guest. I don't do too much international stuff out of this show because it's radio and it's live, and I prefer to have all of my interviews when I can be in studio rather than over the phone, and they just come out better to me when you can sit across the table from somebody. I've never liked phone interviews in all the years I've done radio. So a couple of years back, we filmed two shows for my PBS series. They're up on YouTube if you want to watch them. They're already there. They've already aired, so we've posted them up there. On the cuisine of Peru, we flew into Lima, then got up to Cusco, which is, if you've ever been to Machu Picchu, you'd go through Cusco. It's the high city. It's the staging ground for any trips you're going to take to Machu Picchu. It's a great old city. It's got a great old culture to it. Some really interesting food. We got to see the farmers farming at that altitude, which was crazy. Again, if you've never been there, the altitude's so high. One of the troubles I had, and apparently a lot of people do this, is the first night I couldn't sleep. It was crazy. Uh-huh. Everybody said, don't drink too much alcohol. Then I was like, okay, I won't drink much. Da-da. And I remember like being a good boy and going to bed, at 11 o'clock and laying awake for the next 8 hours, blinking without even yawning. I'm like, this really sucks. I'm not even remotely tired. So the next day I was a basket case, just absolutely dead. But the night after I was good. Anyway, after Cusco, we flew down to Lima, and we visited some really great restaurants, met some really great chefs. We tried to cover a lot of territory, but one of the restaurants that I was really stoked to visit is Restaurant Central, which is in the Miraflores district of Lima, Peru. Lima is the capital of the country. It's a coastal city. It's absolutely beautiful. If you live in Lima and you want to surf, you can just get your board, get on a bus, and get to the beach. It's crazy. I mean, it was breaking with some nice rights the day I was there. Or maybe they were left. I don't remember which way they were going. But it's a city that's on the coastline. And it's also really blessed with an interesting topography. It always seems to me like it was in the fog, like in a mist. Like the closer you got to the water, no matter what it was like 5 miles inland, as you got up to the coast, it was just kind of foggy and kind of gray, and it gets almost no rain. Almost no rain, like literally like it's bone dry. So we were in a few restaurants where there was no roof, and I'm like, what happens when it rains? And they're like, it doesn't rain. So it's crazy. So Miraflores is this neighborhood, this beautiful neighborhood where Central's located, that's maybe a half a mile, maybe a quarter mile in from the coastline. And the restaurant itself, when you're walking down the street, it's a residential street. So there's no, unlike New York where it's commercial and residential and not too mixed. Here it looks like people live in all of these houses. And Restaurant Central is in what almost looks like a big single family house. And then you enter and it's just this gorgeous space that was gut renovated with a kitchen in the back with lots of natural light, a rooftop garden, and a cuisine that's really unique. So anyway, my long-winded intro here is for my guest today, Virgilio, who is the chef at Restaurant Central. He's an amazing guy. Restaurant Central is Do you have Virgilio Martinez is his name? Do you have Michelin yet in Lima?
No, there is no Michelin stars in Lima, but we have one restaurant in London and we have one star.
Okay. And you were, just to give props, I mean, first of all, I was really blown away by his food. It's amazing. He has a great new book out. So again, Virgilio Martinez, Restaurant Central. The book is just called Central or Central, however you want to pronounce it. It's gorgeous. It's published by Faden. To give him his props, I think I'm not the biggest fan of all of the, because now it seems like, I'm an old guy, so I thought it was like Michelin in France was great. And Michelin in Europe was pretty accurate, too. But when Michelin decided to come to New York, I'm like, no fucking way. You don't get out of here. You don't know the city. It's a totally different culture. I mean, I get it. They're trying to sell books. That's what they're doing. But there's also a big list called the Pellegrino list now, which is huge. And I don't know why Pellegrino or how Pellegrino got in the restaurant reviewing business, but they have. And chefs love it. It's a big deal. So Pellegrino picks the top 50 restaurants every year. And it's really pretty important. I remember when Daniel Hum, who's the chef at 11 Madison, the first year that they were told they were on the list, they weren't told where they were on the list, and they flew to London. Daniel and Will, his business partner and co-owner, they flew to London, and they're in that big room with their tuxedos on, and the announcements are going out, 1, 10, 20, 30, and then they're like, every time someone else gets picked, you have this sinking feeling, like, why am I here? And I think they were picked in the 40s the first year, and it just totally bummed them out.
Yeah.
They were just like, they told me they went back to the hotel room and just said, this sucks. How are we going to get better than, how can we get into the top, 20, or how can we get into the top half? And of course, now I think they're number 2 or 3 and your restaurant's number 4 or 5, right?
Yeah. But the first time I was number 50, and I was, kind of the worst of the best.
Right.
It was fun. It wasn't that fun, but yeah, those lists are important for exposure, because before nobody had an idea of Central, and 4 years ago, we were like just, probably the restaurant was maybe 4 guests per day for lunch.
Seriously, that quiet?
15 and 8, and now we do 50-50.
Sold out.
Those lists and those missions, whatever is coming is good. I mean, we are like happy to be there, but we don't work for lists.
Of course.
That's something very clear, because it's very subjective.
Completely subjective. I mean, we all know that.
I mean, being number 1, number 2, number 3, I mean, there's no numbers in cuisine.
I agree with you, but yet, to your case, it really does. Friends of mine who get great reviews, the phone just rings. It generates business. So if you get a good review, if you're lucky enough to have a cuisine that relates to the reviewers, then suddenly they can put you on the map and the phone rings. And like you said, you go from doing 10 covers at lunch to selling the dining room.
Of course, those lists are very powerful. I mean, like they make people travel just to Lima to eat.
Yeah. I guarantee you that if you look at Per Se, Belle Nadan, 11 Madison Park, Jean Georges, on any given day, half the dining room or more is not from New York. Yeah. The people that came to town and just said, I want to, we know we're going to be in October in New York. Let's book a table at 11 Madison if we can. Cause it's tourists, gastronomic tourists. But let's tell your story, because it's funny. So you're a native son, and so you're Peruvian.
Yeah, I'm Peruvian.
Born and raised. So, and Peru is a funny place, because you had for years, politics was really difficult. I mean, you had terrorism, you had kind of an ongoing guerrilla war.
Yeah, I mean, my generation was, we used to struggle with terrorism and all this Sendero Luminoso, all these things,
right.
And blackouts. And at one point we were like thinking about, I mean, we didn't think that there were no opportunities in Lima, so we, most of my generation, we just left Lima and we started to fly. We started to move to, let's say, I went to New York. I worked at Lutes, and then I moved to London. Then I moved to South Asia. So I didn't want to live in Lima until the last 20 years, right, where things have changed a lot. And now Lima is a beautiful city, and I'm so proud to be Limian and Peruvian.
It's funny because when I was doing the trip to Peru, I did a lot of homework. I always try and do a lot of research. And I was trying to go back and trying to follow the food scene in Lima. And it was just like there was no food scene in Lima until like 2002, 2003, 2004. And it was just a couple of chefs then who, just like yourself, every chef I talked to, they were very proud of Peru. They were very proud of the ingredients of the history. But they all said we had to train overseas because there was no restaurant scene in Lima.
No, there were not even cooking culinary schools. And that's why we had to leave. And nowadays we have like let's say like hundreds of culinary schools. The thing is that nowadays we understand that we are not competing, or the chefs, we are not competing because what we want is people from abroad to come to Peru and enjoy different restaurants. And I think we're working, you know, sharing our products and sharing knowledge and stuff like that.
So your background, so your dad was a lawyer, your brother was a lawyer. I'm always curious as to how people became chefs. You went to school, but you didn't feel like acting, like sitting at a desk.
No, I didn't want to.
Right.
No, it wasn't my thing.
So no. You went to cooking school.
I went to cooking school before I wanted to be a pro skateboarder. So
what kind of skate did you do? Freestyle, vert?
Yeah,
freestyle. Urban skating.
Rodney Mullen, you know he was my idol. So I wanted to be like something like that. So I traveled to California and I went to a skate park and I broke my shoulder. And then I went back to Lima and I broke the other shoulder again. And that was it. You know, my family were not
Were you in a half pipe? How'd you break your shoulder?
Half pipe, yeah.
You were in a half pipe.
I mean, I was a street guy, so I don't know why I went to the half pipe. But it is not my thing. It wasn't my style.
Right.
And at one point I was like, what can I do? So I decided to continue traveling, and you know, it's very easy to find a job as a cook, even if you don't speak the language. I moved to Singapore, Bangkok, different places without, you know, speaking Mandarin or whatever I had supposed to be. So I was just peeling potatoes and seeing and you know, learning about cultures, and that was my thing. And I wasn't expecting to come back to Peru because I didn't see any I didn't have this Peruvian identity until now. So probably you've seen that, you know, all these Peruvian chefs, they're very proud of their products and they always talk about this 4,000 variety of potatoes and hundreds of corn and quinoa and all this stuff. So I think there's a lot to do over there.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. So the food scene in Lima is really has just exploded over the last 15, 20 years. And I'm convinced if I went back and somebody was paying for my meal every night, you could eat 30 nights out at 30 different restaurants, never eating the same meal, and you'd eat fantastic.
Yeah, that's great about Peru because the restaurants, they are very, very different.
Yeah.
Because we have like and I think you've been there, like a Nikkei cuisine, like a Japanese Peruvian.
Yeah, because you have those influences. Let's talk about that too. Now we've got tons of time. So, I mean, you have the influence of the natives,
yes.
Right? Almost like an ancient cuisine. And then you have Spanish influence.
Yes.
You have Japanese influence, which I wasn't aware of, which is funny. So you have this kind of Nikkei cuisine that exists. That's kind of a mashup. And then no one can figure out what the origins of it was. But, you know, when you think of ceviche, you think of Peru. This beautiful idea, especially the modern ceviche. Your grandmother's ceviche would have marinated a lot longer and been very overcooked.
You know, and when the Japanese came, they taught us how to marinate ceviche, how to slice the ceviche, how to slice the tirito. You know, even Nobu
correct.
Nobu was working
In Peru before he came.
Before
to the
he came, and he got like all these celebrity chefs, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, so you've got that, this sort of mashup of cuisines, and then the ingredients are just insane. You have such geography. You've got you're right on the coast. So the entire country is wrapped by a coastline, the Pacific coast. But that Humboldt Current was a pretty unique experience. Because
you know that. We have the mangroves, and then we have like a very warm sea, and then we have a very cold sea. So it makes like a different ecosystems.
And tons of bait fish. So lots, there's fish eating fish, eating fish, eating fish. So fish of all kinds of sizes and shapes.
Yeah.
And mollusks. And lots of seaweed now that we're discovering is edible.
Seaweeds,
and you can play with.
We have seaweeds. It's just crazy. How the seaweeds are flying to Japan nowadays. Like, we see. It's just amazing. So we have lots of seaweed. And then we have our desertic coast, which is also inspiring, which is Lima. You mentioned Lima. How foggy and you know, all this humidity. And then we have the valleys in the Andes, which are very bright and colorful. And then we have the altitude of the Cordillera Los Andes, where you find these beautiful potatoes.
You have that story in the book of hiking up to visit someone that you knew, and there was no road, so the road runs out, so you're above, I forget how high, how many meters it was, but like 2,000, something crazy, 2,000 meters above ground, and you hike to this gentleman's farm where he's lived. His wife had just died recently, but his daughter lives nearby, his family is kind of with him, and how many meters above sea level was that?
That was about 3,000 meters above sea level.
It's hard to breathe. You've
been there, and it's hard to breathe. I mean, there's a lack of oxygen out there, and but the soil is, you know, being that high. You know, these people, they don't have an understanding about what's organic, because they have this adoration about the soil. So they just, whenever they want to use pesticides or something, they just take a mortar and they just, you know, crush some chilies and some legumes, and they just add this to the plants, and they really respect what they call the Pachamama, the Mother Earth. Mm. And then when we go to the jungle, to the Amazon, we see how these people is so related. Sometimes they speak to the trees and they speak to the plants, and they have this relationship with plants, which for a guy from like me from Lima, it's quite unique. So we've been working with this for about 10 years, just trying to understand this, the whole cosmovision of all the cultural aspects, and also ingredients and stories. But I think there's more. Probably, you know, these very classic Peruvian dishes like ceviche, lomo saltado. We don't do that. And that's why probably our book is about innovation and showcasing Peruvian, very unknown Peruvian products like edible clays, like algaes in the mountains and stuff like that. Like,
yeah, I've traveled all over Europe. I've eaten it over the years, you know, every three-star Michelin chef that's been, from Freddy Girardet back in the days to Jules Robuchon when he was at Jemat, to Sonderins at Arcastra. I mean, you name them. And then I've watched the American food scene really go from being not so great when I was a young chef. It wasn't the same. We didn't have this great link to the farms. We didn't have big markets to buy everything fresh. Small farmers weren't supplying restaurants. It was still factory farming. So I don't care. When you were at Lutèce, who was the chef? Eberhard Müller?
Yeah.
Yeah, Eberhard. Eberhard and I worked together at Windows. He's a great chef. Really underrated.
And then I got David Few, the other chef. And then, Lutèce sadly closed.
Sadly it closed, because Andre Saltner sold it and Eberhard came in. It was a very hard restaurant to continue. But even in those days, what you were cooking with at Lutèce, what we were getting was, you know, things that were coming in off of a truck. We did the best we could with what we had. But my point is, when I look at American, look at a restaurant like this, Roberta's, and all the restaurants I go to all week long in New York, it's so much better than when I was a young chef. The food's better, the ingredients are better. And it's not so much the technique has changed, it's just the ingredients have gotten much better in America.
Ingredients. I wouldn't say that much. The technique. It's just ingredients, the environment, and the people, and you know, I think emotions are very important. Sometimes we take it for granted. This, you know, how you feel, who is the hospitality thing is very important nowadays, and things are getting more casual. And I think that's good for Latin America, for Peru, because we are very well known to be casual and relaxed. Sometimes too relaxed.
Yeah. I mean, the whole service end is completely changed. The front of the house is completely a different story, too.
No, yeah, our idea is very, well, we are doing like probably, I don't know how to call it, fine dining or whatever, but yeah, I mean, we are so committed to do innovation. We are committed to explore Peru. So once a week, we have to go to different places in Peru. We can go to the jungle, to the Andes, to the different seas, and we have to continue changing the menus and doing more dishes and you know, because we're just getting new ingredients every time.
So what I was trying to say, and I got sidetracked, was there's an older chef that people don't really remember in New York, Larry Forgione. His son Mark Forgione's a big shot now, has a couple of restaurants. His dad, Larry, was really interesting. When his dad was at the River Cafe in the 1980s, he had a menu. I remember eating there, and he had a menu when he was listing all of his American ingredients. That this was the bison was from here, the morels are from Michigan. And I thought, this is really interesting. Nobody was doing anything like that. And now I fast forward to meeting you and then seeing your book and having had the chance to film with you. And I've never met a chef who's more obsessed with, in a good way, with not just cooking locally, but with kind of making it your mission to have, like, your kitchen is part of the Peruvian ecosystem. It's almost like because you literally, like what you just said, you spend a portion of, and your staff, not just you, you spend a portion of your work week literally traveling around the country trying to find new ingredients. And then, I mean, at some point, you made the decision. Well, you talk about the history of the restaurant, because you met your wife at one point. She's a chef, Pia.
Yeah.
You met your wife, and at some point, you want to open up a restaurant together, and you did a bunch of traveling. There were some delays, and then your whole idea for the restaurant kind of changed. Talk about that. Talk about how...
Yeah, I tell you one story, which is very... Yeah, it was obvious. I spent like maybe 10 years just traveling, and when I came back to Peru, I was very influenced by different cuisines. So my food was very eclectic, and probably I was a bit immature to deal with a restaurant with a concept. So people were saying like, "Oh, this is just amazing! This restaurant is amazing! You made me feel like I'm in New York, I'm in London," and I was like so upset, you know, like so. The whole idea of being central is like you have to experience Peru. So we closed the restaurant for a while, and I worked with Pia. And how can we conceptualize Central as a Peruvian restaurant, doing innovation without doing classic dishes? So we designed just tasting menus based on altitudes. So being one of the most biodiverse places in the world,
right?
And we were just traveling, and we were talking to Andean communities and Amazonian communities, and they see that the world in a vertical way, not in a flat, not in a horizontal way. So the way we do, and we said like, oh, why not? I mean, our best approach to nature could be like, you know, if we can start from the sea, then going to the desert, then going to the valleys, and then going to the Andes, and then going to the Amazonia, everything with 16 courses or 18 courses, it depends on, you know.
Right, on the menu.
On the menu. And it's about the exploration. It's about the altitude of Peru. So you mentioned that, of course, when you are like up to 4,000 meters above sea level, probably you don't find much stuff, but you find lots of tubers, because
that's right. You talk about the stuff So when you get to that altitude, it's so bare, it's so hot. There's very little oxygen. It's a lot of direct sunlight. There's wind, so that the life that's there is actually the life that's underground. You discovered these great tubers, and you had, again, back to your friend. He had these these potatoes that he buried that ferment, and you said the first time you saw them, it was almost like, I never have seen them, but they were so pungent, so stinky. You're almost like, how do you even eat this? It's almost disgusting. But then you take them back to the restaurant, and you have a dish with them where you end up, I forget what you do. You boiled, you dehydrated, then you fry it, so it almost looked like a chicharron.
That's a fermentation of potato, which is called tokoş. And that's since the pre-Incas time is a technique. And whenever we bring these potatoes to the kitchen, people is just, you know, people hate that, and they know that the tokoş is all over the kitchen. But it's fun, you know. It's a very nice way to connect to our nature and see how, you know, our food doesn't have to be, all the dishes don't have to be very, very tasty. I think what is important is the whole story about and the experience. I wouldn't say that the dishes are disgusting, but they have to be good. But I think the message is more important. We're talking about preservation of ecosystems.
Yeah.
And which is very important nowadays in our life. And it's not just about promoting Peruvian cuisine. It's not just about promoting Central. Of course, now we're doing a book and we're doing some promotion. But I think we have to think about this ecosystem. When we speak to people in the Andes and in the Amazonia, they're really... committed to their work and their ecosystem, and they want to maintain this very fertile and beautiful landscape.
I think we're all on that page. I was just with a friend of mine on Tuesday night, Pascaline Lapeltier. She's has a restaurant called Rouge Tomate that's just reopening. She's a master sommelier, and she had Isabelle Legeron, who's the London-based master of wine writer. But there were all proponents of natural wine, of just going... For the same reason that, you know, if you go to a vineyard and you're spraying and using chemicals and pesticides and fertilizer, it's dead soil. You're killing everything. So now there's this real blowback. We're going to have the first ever. It's coming up in November. I'll be doing a panel, but we're going to have a natural wine event in Brooklyn next month.
Yeah, because, you know, talking about preservation of ecosystem, I mean, it's very easy to kill the one entire ecosystem just doing one thing.
Yeah.
You know, just cutting one tree, just, you know, like that's why our approach is beyond the foraging. I think we have to understand the whole thing. So we work with different groups of people, like biologists and anthropologists, historians and artists, which are providing knowledge to our work.
So your menu is neat. So I had I don't know how many courses this was, an 8 or 10 or 11 course lunch when I was there. And to your point, so you sit down and there are these descriptions that are kind of suggestive, kind of tongue-in-cheek. But next to every menu description, you're showing where this item comes from in terms of sea level. So the first dish I had was spiders on a rock, and that was minus 5 meters sea level. The next dish I had was high altitude rainforest, it was called. It was 860 meters above sea level. Then we have another dish that was crazy. You tell me what it was if you remember. It was called Andean Plateau, 3,900 feet above sea level, and it was tunta, anato, and black herbs.
Yeah, and coca leaves, yeah.
Crazy.
It's, I mean, crazy.
So this is a menu. I mean, like, the minute you walk in your restaurant, there's this real sense of, even to the point where, tell me when you made the switch, because at some point you decided, so not just we're going to use only Peruvian ingredients like proteins or vegetables or fish, but we don't even want to use like flour or xanthan gum, because you also, your cuisine is very... I don't want to say it's molecular cuisine in a way, but it kind of reminds me of that very modernist cuisine.
Well, yeah, you know, probably when you see this food, you probably see that, oh, this is quite, you know, this label of molecular cuisine, but we are not molecular at all. I mean, it's very difficult now to put a label.
Modernist is all I would say.
Yeah,
but even then, what's that mean?
Yeah, modern.
Yeah, forget labels.
But. It's very important. It's very important what you mentioned about these magic powders that are all over the kitchens worldwide.
Right.
So we're not using these anymore. I mean, we used to use them, and because you can make beautiful things, you know, beautiful like you know, spheres and
right. You can sphericate. You can use xanthan gum. You can create. You can create textures and flavors by manipulation and free. I mean, if you think of what Grant Achatz did at Eleni, what Wiley was doing at WD-50, it's kind of, you know, when I would go in the kitchens, I'm like, they would have these walls of jars labeled, and I'm like, what is this? What? Because when I was a chef, it was flour, water, sugar, salt, pepper. What is all this stuff? And, well, that's, you know, we use these ingredients, and they were like industrial ingredients, really. That
and that's again going back to biodiversity. I mean, having all these ingredients, like why should we using sugar? So we don't serve sugar anymore.
Right.
Our dessert, they don't have sugar, so we extract the sweetness from vegetables, from fruits, from different ingredients.
And even the starches, like you're using
the same starches.
Right, you're using these crazy, which is really, I mean, again, so this is, if you tuned in later, you're wondering what we're talking about. Virgilio Martinez is my guest. His restaurant Central in Lima, Peru. It's almost to me, and this book really goes to this, because it's almost like you have invented your own cuisine. Because when you're bringing in starches, whatever the starches are that you're using, cassava or this and that, and you don't know how much. Is it a teaspoon? Is it a tablespoon? Is it a half? How's it going to work? How's it going to react? You've by research, by trial and error, is the only way you figure this out.
Yeah, that's tricky because, I mean, in the restaurant you have the recipes, but ingredients change, nature change.
Right.
So we put the amounts for the dish that we did for the book, but probably it can't work again. So maybe we have to add a bit more of this bark, a bit more of this freeze dried potato, which is called tunta.
Right. We'll talk about that in a bit too.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, those thickeners and those gums or gels that are coming from natural places.
It's a great story. It's a great book. So we're going to take a quick break to give a shout out to the people that helped pay for this show and other shows on the network. And we're going to come right back and finish the hour with Chef Virgilio Martinez talking about... We're going to bore down a little bit more specifically on some of the dishes in the book and some of the ingredients. Because, again, if you've never been to Peru, it's an astonishingly diverse country for biodiversity in terms of its ecosystems. It's coastal, it's mountainous, it's high plains, it's got everything. So we'll be back right after this spot with Virgilio. Stay tuned for that.
Music for this commercial break is brought to you by Teeth People, and this track is called Poetry Is Dead.
She's her own female. She's her own female. That's why I like her. I like her a lot.
Hey, folks. Mike Halimeko here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Colavita family brand for years, and there really is a Colavita family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Colavita. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Colavita family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable source olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Colavitas living in Rome, Colavitas living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I'd recommend you try it as well. So when you think of the great wine regions of the world historically, I mean, you're going to be led back to Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne, okay, maybe Piedmont, Italy, too. And as a chef growing up, boy, if you were working in great restaurants in the 70s and 80s, they were mostly all French, and we grew up drinking Bordeaux and Burgundy and Champagne with impunity. Well, fast forward to today, and I just got back from the 2015 Bordeaux Harvest. We were there for a week with a bunch of sommeliers. It was so much fun, and I'll tell you... this isn't your grandfather's Bordeaux. There's a whole new generation of young vignerons working with this great terroir that they've lived on, this soil that they know that they've grown up with, and the great varietals that we all know and love, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc, Petit Verdot, Malbec. You know, this style of Bordeaux now that's younger, that's fresher, that's meant to be consumed now and not cellared, because honestly, which of us has a cellar? And who wants to buy a bottle of wine and wait 10 years? So, the Bordeaux whites are amazing, you know, Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon, like, hello, two grapes that we know. The reds tell all sorts of different stories, from the left bank style that are a little more Cabernet Sauvignon driven, a little more structured, right bank a little more Merlot, a little easier, a little more upfront friendly. But if you haven't thought about drinking Bordeaux wine, give it another shot. For $15 to $35 in that price range, which is my price range, there's tremendous value in there. So if you're walking past a Bordeaux wild, stop, grab a great bottle. These are some of the most food-friendly wines on planet Earth. Hey, we're back. Didn't take long. All right. Again, my guest is Virgilio Martinez. His restaurant is Central. It's in Lima, Peru. So to the biodiversity bit. So I've traveled a lot, and I remember once I was on one of the Hawaiian Islands, and just it was amazing. I mean, you have the coastline, you've got elevations all the way up, you got these incredible temperature swings, you've got active volcanoes.
Well, of course.
You've got a whole lot of microclimates present on one little island. And then when I was reading about Peru, in the world, we now have listed 117 different microclimates.
Yes.
Peru has 84.
Yeah.
That's crazy. That just kind of goes to the diversity.
That's crazy, and that allows us to be aware of what's our challenges, you know, like using these ingredients. But I think the message of it, you can do it doesn't exclude anybody to do this thing in different places. Like you mentioned, one country, another country. It's not just about Peru. The thing is that yeah, of course, in Peru we are very close to the Andes and we are close to the Amazonia, so we just. Sometimes we go like only 20 kilometers and you find another microclimate with something totally different. And that's amazing. So that's what we do. So we kind of are exploring, cooking.
Quite literally. I mean, literally. You're saying that and I can see people rolling their eyes, but you're literally traveling around with your crew to the far corners of the country in sources of inspiration and ingredients.
Yeah, because we get pictures of the landscape. I can be staring for 5 hours maybe one beautiful landscape in the Andes and just see ingredients, and then I get the idea. So when people ask, because this is a very common question, how's your creative process? I say, like, I'm just, you know, listening and talking to people and just looking at the landscape and just getting ingredients.
You had a story. I'm trying to figure out what page. You'll remember better than I. You had a story where you're on one of these trips and you're sitting on a coastline. This is it. You're sitting. Well, anyway, talk about this dish, Fossil de Concha, however you describe it.
Yeah.
Because this is exactly what you're talking about, this imagination taking you to a place. So you're high up somewhere in the desert and you're looking at the ground or whatever it was, and you find what looks like a scallop shell. And you're thinking, holy shit, like a million years ago, this was underwater.
Yeah.
And then how do I combine that? So talk about what this dish is, because it really speaks to your process and the restaurant.
Yeah, it's about just seeing and traveling, and in that plate we saw this fossil of concha of scallops, and then we decided to do something with that. It's not very easy because of course when we talk about local cuisine, probably people think that we are, yeah, of course, we are Peruvian, we are locals, but we are not locals. We cook with the sea, we cook with the Andes, we cook with the Amazonia. So for that dish, we had to go to the sea, and in the north of Peru, and we had to explore. We had to see how the scallops are you know, growing, and even most of the plates that we are using are coming from if you see a photo. The plate is a fossilized scallop shell.
It's gorgeous. It's crazy. I mean, that's what you're serving it on. And what's tumba? What is this tumba? Because it's kind of, it's, you're using that in this dish as well.
Yeah, you know, before the Spanish came to Peru, we didn't have limes.
Right. So, no limes, no lemon, nothing. So no citrus.
Our ceviche, and that's probably, yeah, we want to believe that the story is, that's the right story, that we have the tumbo, this passion, because we have lots of passion fruits. And the first ceviches were made with passion fruits.
Hmm.
Without lemon, you know, because we need acidity. So,
right, because acidity is really what the only thing that's, quote, cooking the fish.
Yeah, it's cooking the fish. So, you know, fishermen were just, you know, getting fish in their boats, and they were doing ceviches a la minute with the tumbo fruits. So they were just slicing the fish, and they, then just adding tumbo, and probably they used to wait like maybe 4 hours, 5 hours for the fish to be cooked. But nowadays, since again this melting pot and all these influences, when the Japanese came, they were like, "Hey, no, don't do that. just do 40 seconds with the acidity and the fish." And that's fine. That's nice about Peru, because I see we are very open minded to listen to people, and I think, yeah, of course, we had this influence of Japanese, Chinese, and Arabs, and then Spanish and Italian. So it's quite a place, a very good place to go. And yeah, of course, we don't do that cuisine, because I think it's very difficult to compete to a Chinese Peruvian who has been doing
right. That's their vocabulary. Yeah, that's their native tongue.
Yeah.
What you're doing. I mean, I think Virgilio. I mean, what makes you so exceptional is, I think you're, of all the Peruvian chefs that I met in the restaurants that we visited, either they were, I don't want to say more traditional, but I kind of understood what they were doing in terms of their culinary vocabulary, if I could use that term.
Of course.
And what you're doing is you're inventing a new culinary vocabulary. It's like a new language, because you're going out and getting ingredients that are very unfamiliar, even for chefs in Peru, because you're traveling to the far corners of the country to find some crazy root, some crazy tree bark, some crazy, I mean, you have that, well, we'll talk about some of them. And then you're bringing them back into the kitchen, and it's kind of like you don't have a map to work with, because there is no, oh, my grandmother did that with this dish, or I once worked with a chef that did that with this dish, or I once waited at a restaurant. The answer is none of the above. I have no idea what I'm going to do with this. I'm just going to figure out what its characteristics are, and that's a different way of cooking.
No, yeah, of course. We're very happy that whenever you see a dish of Central, you're like, oh, this is Central. Yeah, this is Peru. This is a landscape. Those are Peruvian products, and I think that's quite good. We love to say like we are creating a new
lexicon, vocabulary.
Vocabulary, yeah, about food.
You are. I mean, I don't think anybody can argue. And if you don't believe me, grab a copy of the book, folks. If you can't get to Lima, which you really should do.
You know, I don't want to be pretentious about saying like we are creating something which is gonna change things, but I think we're doing big changes in some regions. The economy are changing. I mean, we are using some ingredients that were just there, like this cuchuro, this cyanobacteria, and these algae. They were just there, and
so talk about that dish, because they come from a lake, right?
Yeah,
I had that when I was there. Talk about that dish, because it's crazy. What is this? What's the story behind this dish?
Yeah, we went once to very high in the Andes, and people were saying like, yeah, when it happens to rain a lot, these little spheres of Andean water start to appear.
And looks like caviar or something, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right.
And we have to go. I mean, we talked to the producers, and they're like, oh, they are there. So we have to take a flight the day after, 4 in the morning, and we get there with the team, and we just go and collect them one by one, and we take them to Central.
Which
that's our work. I mean, if, you know, having a restaurant, having a tasting menu is difficult. But I think it's which is more difficult is having this connection with people, yeah, and not calling suppliers, because that would be it would be very easy to call a supplier and say like, oh, just take the phone and say like, I need carrots, I need this and this and this. And this. I think having this team just going for the ingredients is making us very proud, and is, of course, they just don't go for products, they go for stories, and they go to yeah, connect people. And now we are so connected with food, like it's just amazing how food is connecting the whole world.
Yeah, I mentioned to you before we started this setup that we were in Poland 4 or 5 years ago filming 2 or 3 shows, and I had a really great fun. One of the Polish food wasn't exactly my bag. It tends to be very heavy and porky and potatoey. But there's this one chef, Wojciech Amaro, who's in Warsaw, has a Michelin star.
Great chef.
He's amazing, and he's Polish, born and bred, and super proud of, like you, super proud of his country. But when you think of Poland, you know there's no coastline. You don't think there's no viticulture, there's no wine. So it's kind of, and it's had not unlike Peru, it's had kind of a tough cultural history. Sitting between the Soviet Union and Germany wasn't the most comfortable backyard to be in, right, for the years historically. But Wojciech keeps a list. He has these huge books of what's available every day of the year, 365 days a year, from Poland. He only uses Polish ingredients. And he told me, he said, you know, when I get to September, it's crazy because, like, by the third week of September, that's the best. I have, like, 365 ingredients that I can source from.
That's amazing.
My guys call me up and they say, there's a mushroom available now, or there's a lake fish that's available now. And then that's how he does, too. So he's, like you, he's finding inspiration in sourcing and networking with people throughout his country for really obscure things that turn out to be delicious. But yeah, you're not going to call up your purveyor.
Yeah, but when you see these guys, that, you know, the cooks going to the Andes and they come up with ingredients, they're so like proud and they're like, they are amazed. So they go back to the kitchen and they see the products in a right, different way.
Right, they're stoked. They're completely
because they've experienced maybe the whole day just picking one by one of these little spheres,
right,
and it's totally different than just call one supplier and say, oh, bring me 2,000 of these little spheres, and you know.
I get it. So you have, again, we're getting back to the book again. Virgilio Martinez is my guest. The name of the book, Central, which is the name of his restaurant in Lima, Peru. Peru's famous for its vast variety of potatoes. It's the birthplace of potatoes. You've got hundreds of varieties. And I saw corn everywhere I went, and all kinds of different corn. So you have a dish in this book called Diversidad de Maíz. But it's a play around. Let's talk about that dish again, because it's not like when that plate comes to your table, it's 5 different types of corn or something. It's like you have to think. It's this intellectual thing. Talk about what this dish is and how you make it.
Yeah, we were inspired about the harvesting of corn and these different varieties. And we, of course, we support varieties and different species. So when we saw these great corns and different colors, different flavors and different textures, we try to make one dish which in one ecosystem that people is just growing this corn. And yeah, we just create one dish which is coming at the beginning as a snack. So we make a kind of a liquefied ceviche of corn. And then we use the husk of the corn. Then we use yellow corn, blue corn. We use red corn. We use cancha corn. We use another one called San Jerónimo corn. And yeah, it's, well, the good thing about corns in Peru is that sometimes you don't get this in Cusco, but then you go to another place, Ayacucho or some other place in Indes, and you get them. So for us, it's difficult to understand seasonality.
Mm.
Because when I was trained as a chef, everything was about seasonality, and then everything was getting molecular, and then everything was getting local. So I think, yeah, because of our geography, I think we deserve to do something different.
What's the tumbo fruit being used for here? Only the pulp. What are you using that for as an ingredient?
As a sweetener.
As a sweetener. This is, again, so one of these ingredients that you source, you also have this ají amarillo, which I've seen. This is, that's like everywhere. That's
I think probably that's one of the most important ingredients in Peru.
Talk about that dish, because I saw it almost everywhere we went. Talk about what it is, how it's made.
The ají amarillo.
Yeah.
Well, ají amarillo is an ingredient.
Right.
It's a yellow chili pepper.
It's a yellow pepper.
Yeah, and we use a lot to make sofritos. You know sofrito, of course.
Right.
But our sofrito has like a... It's very traditional. It has like onions, olive oil, garlic, and then at the end we add, let's say, a brunoise of ají amarillo or a paste of yellow chili pepper. And with that, you have a base of... I think that's the base of Peruvian cuisine.
It seemed everywhere I went, whether it was mostly in puree form, that sort of nice, thickened yellow puree, but the taste was amazing. Like a sofrito, but it has a sweetness and that peppery edge.
Yeah, that's the sweetness and a little bit of, you know, spiciness.
A bit of spice.
Yeah.
Talk about avocados in Peru, because you guys are like the biggest exporters, but there's all kinds of avocados. You talked about being, I forget which part of the country you were in. I'll turn my pages quickly here, but an avocado there's an avocado in Peru that exists somewhere that's big and round and you can almost eat it like an apple.
Yeah, and actually that avocado that we're using, you know, it's funny because we used to serve foie gras at Central. And
you used to serve foie gras.
Yeah, and foie gras is not part of our culture. It's not part of our... It's not part of... I like foie gras, of course. But I think this... I didn't want to send a message. So we're trying to find the foie vegetal, you know, the foie gras, the vegetable foie gras. And we found this avocado, and we pan-seared the avocado. And it actually has this, I mean, it's not foie gras, but...
No, but it's funny. As I'm thinking about it as a chef, avocados are very fatty. They're full of oil, right? It's not animal fat. It's natural fat.
Yeah.
And I remember once another chef friend I knew got an avocado, and a traditional avocado, but grilled, cut it in half and grilled it like a steak right over the flames. And I remember eating it thinking, God, it's like really well-marbled meat.
Yeah, maybe 10 years ago, nobody believed about, you know, grilling avocado, roasting avocado.
Right.
And that's what we do.
You treat it like a protein. You treat it like a piece of meat.
Yeah. And most of our food is like, basically it's vegetables. And then, of course, proteins are coming, but not in a big portion.
And all right, so in this dish, I'm just going to bore down. So we have this dish called palto. I'm not going to mispronounce it, but it's an avocado. When it gets to the plate, I'm not sure you'd quite recognize it. But as you're reading the ingredients, it's got beet powder, one ingredient. It's got white and green lake algae crunch. Yeah. And again, this is the kind of stuff that, like, you know, what is that? So you're clearly going.
That dish is coming from the Sacred Valley in Cusco, and. We saw these beautiful avocados, and then we saw these algae
forming in the water.
We saw the beets. We saw also kiwicha, which is amaranth, and then we decided to use the whole avocado. So the sauce is made with the skins of the avocado. Then we covered the avocado with the leaves of the avocado tree. So it's quite a very good experience about using the whole avocado,
right?
And adding this sense of ecosystem, of course, which is our main message.
When one of the things that I remember seeing in the kitchen was because it was hanging on the wall. I think it was pretty obvious. Talk about this beef heart dish that you have, because it's funny. It's very, you don't see a lot of meat. I think you had a short rib on my lunch menu. That was a protein that was a more familiar protein. But, you know, you don't see, you don't like, as a chef, for whatever reason, philosophically, personally, preferentially, I don't know, you can tell me, but you're not a very meat-centric restaurant. You're not going to get like a pork chop or a chicken breast or a cut of steak ordered medium rare or foie gras. I mean, things that we normally associate with restaurant dining or fine dining. But the beef heart, tell me about that beef heart and how you use it and how it comes to be what I saw just hanging there on the wall, preserved or smoked or salted or whatever it was.
That dish, the heart of the beef, there's nothing new about that because we do like kind of anticuchos, like brochettes of heart grilled. But in this case, we cover the avocado with cacao and ají panca, which is red chili pepper, which is not that spicy. We cover it with this cacao leaves. And we let it dry for 3 days until the heart start to reduce, and then we go to the dining room, the chefs,
and grate,
and we grate the heart. So it's quite impressive.
Yeah, you know? It is. The thing's pretty gnarly looking.
Some people get a bit upset, seeing this heart and. But I think it's part of the. I mean, we need to provide some, of course, some fun.
This is again. This is so you're out foraging. I don't know who you're with, your wife, your crew, whatever. This dish, arbol y alga dulce. So you're wandering around the last day of a trip, looking for a kind of a tree, a warango tree, which is found in high temperatures, facing the blah blah. And you're on the beach, and you just create. You have this idea of creating flavors, and talk about that because this is again this sort of spontaneous. The idea of recipes coming to you, by just seeing.
And that's going back to the creative process. That sometimes we go for 20 ingredients or one ingredient, and we end up, finding nothing. Sometimes we go for one ingredient, and we end up finding like 40. Yeah. And that day we're like tired of we didn't see anything, so we say like, okay, let's just go to the beach
let's chill,
yeah. And we were just swimming, and we saw all these great seaweed and the warango trees, which are trees that grow in a very desertic coast. So we were let down because we didn't see anything back in the mountains, and we went to a desert, and we found everything there. We're not supposed to find stuff, in a deserted coast.
It's crazy. What's mashua? Mashua. What is that?
Yeah, that's a vegetable root.
How do you use it?
Yeah, we cover it with salt and we.
This is what it looks like. I'm sorry, on page one. This is what it looks like.
Yeah. And if you see
kind of like a tuber.
Page, we cover it with salt. And we can serve them raw, slice the mashua, and then we cover it with salt, and then we just bake the mashua. And also we cover it with clay, and we bake the mashua, and we serve the mashua with clay, so people have to break the
table side.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of that. I remember there was a lot of... Not a drama, like you said, the beef hearts grated in the dining room. There were sauces that were applied in the dining room that come out of little. Even your plates were beautiful. Your like beautiful pottery, beautiful ceramic slabs of rock.
Yeah, I think at one point we love to do that, like in an artistic way, and we think that what we do sometimes is art. I'm not afraid to say that. But of course, every single dish has a meaning, and and we do different stuff with dishes and ingredients.
So another dish you had, because some of the food, I mean, some of the plates, again, if you haven't seen this book, it's amazing. The name of the book is Central, Virgilio Martinez, the chef. It's his restaurant and his wife's and his crew's in Lima, Peru. It's pretty astonishing if you ever get to Lima. And if you're going to go to Lima and 3 months in advance, try and book a table. I'll put it that way. Go in for lunch and dinner. And we're not going to talk about the restaurant's beautiful. You walk in, it's like a brownstone building. Upstairs is like a laboratory where you have got like library of books. You're encouraging your whole staff to go upstairs and play, to cook, to experiment.
Yeah.
You have a garden on the roof. You also have crazy, I don't know, you tell me, why do you have that? It was like a reverse osmosis water filtration system in the restaurant. All of the restaurant water you cook with and you serve the customers is in your own bottle. And you have a pretty expensive looking unit up there on the second.
You know, at the beginning, the water that was just for the staff. And then we decided to use this water for our garden. And then we decided to bottle the water and serve the water for the people, for the guests. With, you know, instead of using,
tap water.
Yeah, tap water or even water coming from Italy. France.
Someplace else, right? A bottled water of Pellegrino.
Which is not part of our ideas. So, we are talking about recycle our bottles, using our water.
And the wine list was great. I remember that part, too. Even though we had lunch, we didn't drink much wine. Who's in charge of your wine program?
We have Greg Smith. He's American, and he's in charge of the wine program. And
it was really beautiful, really well-curated list. I remember walking through the cellar and thinking, wow, recognizing some bottles. He had some really unusual finds in there, too. So.
Yeah. You know, I have no idea about the wine program because I trust so much on the team. There's five guys in charge of the wines, and they're doing great job about wines, and then the experience of the wine is just amazing. And I don't see that because I think there's so much information nowadays for chefs. You know, we're talking about explorations and then the cooking and staying in the restaurant. So I think we need to leave this to the experts.
And there's more and more of them. I have a lot of wine guests on this show all the time. I travel. I mean, we filmed the 2005 Beaujolais Harvest. We were in Bordeaux filming the harvest last year. I've been to Albarino's Main, Riches Paisches. We were just in Champagne a few months ago. For me, wine has to be every night with dinner. But there's amazing how the education of wine is just increasing. There's so many smart, younger kids today on the floor in their 20s that are just like expert sommeliers. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's nuts.
Yeah.
In New York, it's off the hook.
It's growing, yeah.
Talk about this dish. Because this, it's fun. I open up this page, and a lot of the the food that you see in the book is on purpose. I don't want to say manipulated, but you have a lot of technique, and you've kind of changed the texture. You've played with the color. You're playing with textures and colors and cooking methods across the board. So sometimes when the food comes to the customer, it's not exactly recognizable in a traditional way. It's kind of like you have to sort of think and dissect it and take it apart and taste pieces. But then I see this dish called Amarillo de Tuberculosis or whatever it's called. This thing that looks like ramen. What is this dish? This is so cool.
Yeah, I was about to say that. It looks like ramen.
I get this and I'm like, oh yeah, okay, this looks like ramen noodles, but it isn't ramen. What is this dish and what was the inspiration?
Because we were just... we had so many tubers, and we decided to do one dish, what warm dish with tubers, and you know, slice them like spaghetti style, and the broth is coming from the water from the same tuber, so it's, you know, we make more power to the tuber in that dish because which is a, I think it's a mashua or so we serve the mashua we serve with a broth of mashua and then we add Andean herbs.
It's beautiful, really, 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 really beautiful. One last one, and then we're going to let you go. What did I make a note of here? There was something again. The name of the book is Central. It's great. Virgilio is a super talented chef. I was lucky enough to eat at his restaurant. Unfortunately, I couldn't have stayed as long as I wanted or eaten as much as I wanted.
Yeah, your agenda were...
I remember this dish. Okay, now I glad. So, chocos andinos. So one of the things you served, and I don't know whether it came as a portion by itself or whether it was part of another dish, but I remember it came to the table, and it looked sort of familiar and unfamiliar at the same time. And then I went to eat it, and it reminded me of my Italians eat a lot of polenta, so it's coarse ground cornmeal. And my grandmother, who was a great, great, great cook, used to always make, we'd eat polenta with tomato sauce. It's like instead of pasta with meat and tomato sauce, and it's like a peasant food because it's cheap. It's ground up grains. But then she would always make extra polenta, refrigerate it, and saute it in the morning. So we'd crisp it up in a pan, and I to this day, I love it. I would eat polenta with bacon and eggs, or polenta with sausage and eggs, sometimes a little maple syrup. It was beautiful. So this comes to our table in Lima, and I'm looking at it, I'm smelling it, and I'm poking it, and then I take a bite, and I'm like, what?
But that's great, because with that example, we're playing with memories.
So talk about this dish, because it reminded me of, like, kind of on purpose, like a scorched, super dense cornbread, like cornmeal, cornbread in America.
Yeah, it's ready to cornbread, it's ready to tortillas. We call it choclos andinos, and for us, it's a celebration of the harvest of corn. So whenever we find the best corn, we do that plate. And
how is it made? How do you do it? So you have fresh corn coming in?
Yeah, we have fresh corn, and we just grate the corn with the water coming from the leftovers of the corn.
Which is full of starch.
Very, very starch, yeah. And then we just put in molds, and we bake it.
So it's just thickens.
So methods are different because, yeah, of course, we are inspiring. Our inspiration is coming from the ingredient and the people. And actually, that corn thing... We experienced one preparation in the Andes with some families, and we did something different, but that's the idea, and we just torch at the end just to make this smokiness.
But it's great, because it's so here in one meal I'm seeing, like, this really kind of astonishing manipulative technique, but all for an end, not manipulation for its own sake. There's very modernist cuisine, and then suddenly this thing arrives on the table that looks like I could have eaten this in someone's hut 5,000 feet above sea level, that grandma ground up corn with a pestle, smashed it into a ball, and stuck it on the side of an oven. Like, that's, like, very primal, basic food.
Yeah, you know,
as simple as it gets.
Because sometimes we have, like, so unknown products and so unknown dishes that you don't have a reference.
And right.
If we continue doing like this for the, we always think like this. If we do, like, maybe 5 courses that you have no idea of them, at one point you are not going to be feeling, like, probably happy, because you're going to be, like, lost. So at one point we need to play with your memory.
It worked. I mean, it actually, look, I'm telling you, as I got that, because everyone on the table, my cameraman was there, and the other, no one knew what it was, and I said, wait, and I'm telling them, I said, it's cornmeal, it's corn, this is like, this is really simple, this is like really like ancient Indian cooking, this is as basic as it gets, someone was making this dish 6,000 years ago, something like this dish.
Yeah.
But so it was great. It totally worked. It was out of context with the rest of the meal. But yeah, very comforting in a way, because suddenly this thing comes. It's like, oh, an old friend.
Now I know this guy.
Now I've got a reference for him. Virgilio, so cool, man. Surfer, skateboarder. I guess we're all glad that you didn't get sponsored by Vans or any of the big board companies, because you broke a shoulder and ended up in a kitchen and traveling the world And it's so neat, because I think, too, you know, in reading your book and in kind of hearing your story, you know, you would, like, 10 years ago, you were much less of a chef than you are now. 5 years ago, you were a partial chef. So you're one of these guys who continues to push. The restaurant continues to evolve.
Oh, yeah.
You've got a great team. Your wife is in the kitchen with you. Congratulations on the baby. 9 months old. That's great news. Thanks for coming to New York.
No, thank you for being here, and yeah.
So, folks, if you're planning a trip to Lima, and you know in advance you're going, try and book a table lunch or dinner at Restaurant Central in the Miraflores district. It's really an eye-opening place, really, really a game changer. And if you can't get there, then buy the book. It's called Central. The author is the chef Virgilio Martinez. Faden is the publisher. It's the next best thing, I suppose, to being there. Thanks for coming on. We'll see you next week, folks. Thanks for listening to Food Talk. Mike Colomeco signing off. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for the invitation.
Whoa, oh, oh, oh. Whoa, oh, oh, oh. Whoa, oh, oh, oh. Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.